Hello and welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host. We have a listener of the week, Lynette Johnson in Virginia. She tweeted, listened to an old Tony Martinetti podcast with Professor John List on the way to work today. Great stuff. Thanks. Thank you, Lynette. That was from the February 8th, 2013 show. And I'm going to have to replay that one. I'm glad you brought it to my attention. That's a very good one. Lynette Johnson, listener of the week. Thank you so much for your love of nonprofit radio. We have a new affiliate station. Welcome, WLRI 92.9 FM in Lanchester. That's Lancaster and Chester counties, Pennsylvania. They're a Pacifica Radio affiliate also. Nonprofit radio is there on Saturdays and Sundays at 10 a.m. Welcome, WLRI, to our family of affiliates. And welcome to the listeners in Southeast Pennsylvania. They're in Lanchester. Love it. Oh, I'm glad you're with me. I'd bear the pain of osteochondrodysplasia if I heard even a skeleton of the idea that you missed today's show. Policy versus paperclips. Eugene Fram is author of the book, Policy versus Paperclips. He introduces you to a corporate model of board governance to cut out the minutiae from your agendas so your board can focus where it should on policy and planning. He's Professor Emeritus at Rochester Institute of Technology, and that originally aired on April 26th, 2013. Lots of great shows from 2013. On Tony's Take Two, my dream realized. We're sponsored by Pursuant, full-service fundraising, data-driven and technology-enabled. You'll raise more money. Pursuant.com. And by Crowdster, online and mobile fundraising software for nonprofits. Now with Apple Pay, Crowdster.com. Eugene Fram, coming up. Here he is from April of 2013. Of course, I said lots of good shows from 2013. There were lots of good shows in 2014 and 2015. And we've had several in 2016 also. So are you looking at the Nonprofit Radio Archive? Just go to TonyMartinetti.com, search whatever keywords you need, and all the shows related will show up. Here's Eugene Fram showing up. My pleasure now to welcome Eugene Fram. He is Professor Emeritus at Rochester Institute of Technology. He's a consultant, board chair, and volunteer director for nonprofits. He has authored co-authored more than 125 journal articles on marketing and nonprofit and corporate governance. He wrote the book Policy versus Paperclips, which you can find on Amazon, to introduce a governance model that we're going to talk about. On Twitter, he's at Eugene Fram, F-R-A-M, just like the oil filter. Eugene Fram, welcome.
Welcome. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you. It's morning in California on the day that we're recording, very early morning, so thank you for joining me this early from the left coast.
It's my pleasure.
Gene, are you part of the Fram filter family by any chance?
Unfortunately, I am not.
You are not. Are those things still around? I don't own a car. I haven't had a car for years. Are Fram oil filters still around? Do you know?
Well, I think they're still on the web. I've seen them.
Okay, you have. But that's not you. I'm sorry.
And that's not me.
That's all right. I'm not part of the great Martinetti liquor family in Boston and New England either. So
okay.
The both of us are suffering from famous names and chronic underrepresentation in those wealthy families.
Yes, we've been born with huge handicaps.
I'm still trying to overcome mine. I hope you have overcome yours. 125 articles.
Yeah, somewhat, but my ambition is to go to 1,000.
So. Oh, okay. Well, now that you're in retirement, you have more time for that,
Professor. Yes, that's true,
Professor Emeritus.
Yes,
Gene, what's happening with boards? Why do you feel they are missing the mark?
Well, boards from a governance point of view, nonprofit boards and from a governance point of view, frequently have retained the old 19th or 20th century model of governance, where the board has a multitude of committees and tries to eventually micromanage the staff. In the process, nothing gets done, or the organization, although it has potential, has stunted growth. if it in that way, because volunteers like myself, and again, as I talk, I'm not talking as a nonprofit CEO or ED. I'm talking as a volunteer director. We can't be there day to day. And we can't manage the minutia that is, the work that really needs to be done. And we can't really manage truly professional staff. We can help. We can advise. We can help. We have an obligation to set policy, but we're simply part-timers, or as some person has described it, we are birds of flight through the organization, because we're there traditionally 3 to 6 years, and the staff stays and works under different boards.
Your concern is that despite the well-meaning board and individual members having great potential and the best interests of the organization at heart, you feel they're actually, through these old models, stunting the organization.
Absolutely, and I think it can be proven when you look at any number of organizations which have suffered this way.
Do you want to give an example or two?
Well, I've consulted with a number of them, but I don't want. Oh, yeah, I'll talk to generalities, not specific organizations, where the board actually got where the volunteers on the board actually got involved to the level that they were managing departments. A decision had to be made, the department head first went to the volunteer advisor or whatever they called him at the time, and then went to the ED with the advisor's either decision or concern or whatever the department head wanted. So the organization didn't grow until they finally changed the model.
Yeah, full-time employees reporting to a part-time volunteer director?
Part-time person, exactly.
Oh, my. All right. Let's start with the beginning of the process, and we will get to the corporate model that you lay out in your book.
Fine.
We will get to that. Let's take a couple of discrete sort of timeline points and along a board member's life cycle with the organization. And I'd like to start with recruitment. Makes sense, I think.
Mm-hmm.
What can we improve around our board recruitment?
Well, the chief executive officer, whether they be an ED or a president and CEO, as I suggest, needs to have more contact with the board, with individual board members. I think they have to have more contact between meetings that has to be often informal, and they have to they need to get to know each other. And I suggest that they actually meet quarterly to informally discuss the concerns and the challenges that the chief executive officer is facing. There are various techniques for doing this. I recently read in the Harvard Business Review a recommendation that for-profit CEO actually sends a email out to the board every Sunday morning, laying out very briefly, in this case, his concerns about what's going on in the organization and what new ideas he has.
Now,
as he indicated in the article, he says, "I don't worry about grammar."
Right. Now, Gene, I'm trying to focus on recruitment, so. Maybe in this board meeting, as often as you're suggesting, they're identifying gaps in the board, and maybe they can try to fill those gaps with new board members.
That's right.
Okay, and but as they're going through that recruiting process to identifying skills that they need, that the board is lacking, how should they be talking to potential board members?
Well, they should talk to board members what they do is to value their contributions of time, the most important thing. And they make meaningful use of the board member's time. They don't ask the board member, the potential board member, to do frivolous things such as stuff envelopes or get involved with watching slideshows or commenting on slideshows is one that I've heard of. Mm. So that they focus on the policy and the strategic issues of the organization.
Okay, we're going to take a break now, Gene, and when we return, we'll keep talking about a little about the life cycle of the board member, and then we'll get into the corporate model that you lay out in policy versus paperclips. So,
okay,
I know
thank you.
Gene is going to stay with us, and I hope you do too.
You're tuned to Nonprofit Radio. Tony Martinetti also hosts a podcast for the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Fundraising Fundamentals is a quick, 10-minute burst of fundraising insights published once a month. Tony's guests are expert in crowdfunding, mobile giving, event fundraising, direct mail, and donor cultivation. Really, all the fundraising issues that make you wonder, am I doing this right? Is there a better way? There is. Find the Fundraising Fundamentals archive at tonymartinetti.com. That's MARTIGNETTI. Remember, there's a G before the N. Thousands of listeners have subscribed on iTunes. You can also learn more at the Chronicle website, philanthropy.com. Fundraising Fundamentals, the better way.
Welcome back. I'm with Gene Fram, and we're talking about policy versus paperclips and focusing your board where its attention ought to be on policy and planning and things like that. So, Gene, question about in the recruitment process, the expectations around time and fundraising for potential board members. We're still now just talking about the potential member. What should a nonprofit be revealing about time and fundraising?
Well, they first ought to be very clear about the time commitment expected, and they ought to delve into a deep discussion with the board member on this, because I've just consulted with an organization that has recruited some very fine people who are working and people who are building their careers, and they lay out they discuss the time commitment for the organization, but in the final analysis, after being on the board for 3 to 6 months, the people have huge work commitments, and they say, "Gee, I just can't meet the time commitments." So they've had to restructure the board in a way that allows the chairman much more responsibility, I think, than a board chair should have.
And what about the fundraising expectations?
Well, not all board members will enjoy fundraising. I think it's necessary to find those who might enjoy it or have experience with it to make some commitment to it.
Do you want to see that as a dollar amount or more flexible based on the individual?
Based on what the individual's strengths are. If they have contacts, that's one thing. If they have dollars to give or able to network with people of substantial wealth, that is another thing.
Okay. But there ought to be, do you agree with this, 100% participation personal at some level for all board members?
Yes, that's necessary, because foundations, when you go for grants, often look at that as a board commitment, showing board commitment that they have made the financial commitment to the organization.
Should these expectations be in writing for the potential board member?
I think so, but I think it depends upon the culture of the board and the understandings that are developed at the beginning. If the board gets a lot of questions after being on the board for a while about those commitments, maybe it's necessary to put it into writing.
Okay. But not necessarily a legally binding contract, I would
think. Oh, no, right? No.
Okay, but just something that here's what we're expecting, and please, you know, indicate that you've reviewed it so we all have consistent expectations.
Right. Okay. We're all on the same page.
Okay. So then moving to orientation, if you recruited the right people, what should board orientation look like?
Well, orientation should take place, I would say, size and complexity of the board, about a six-month period. And in the sense that there might be a half day or a couple hour orientation about the organization and its mission, vision, and values, and any other details that they have to be concerned with. But then other issues ought to be brought up for the new board members as they progress through their first 6 months. During this period, the board chair and the CEO need to be readily available to answer questions from the new board members, so that they become fully apprised of the issues as they go along. A two-day board session in which a lot of information is thrown at the person simply doesn't stick. It's a matter of repetition, understanding, and going through the process themselves. And as you know, we all learn best when the problems are immediately in front of us. For example, with board liabilities, a lot of boards will bring in a lawyer and lay out the potential liabilities for a board member in their particular situation. And they hear a lot about the laws, but if you're not a lawyer, they frequently forget it. So when an issue comes up that there might be a personal liability in the situation, it's up to the CEO and the board chair to remind the new people and refresh the older people that this particular situation might be affected by this particular legal precedent.
Would you put new board members on a committee right away, or would you keep them at large?
I would keep them at large unless they have a strong desire to go on a committee. And, of course, as you know, I suggest that there are really only three committees needed.
Yeah, and this is a way of getting into the corporate model. What are those three committees?
Well, first, it's very simple. You have a planning and resource committee that looks forward. It looks towards the strategic plan. It looks towards the resources that I have, both human resources and financial resources. It looks forward to the planning that is necessary. Mm-hmm. It also has a special responsibility that the other committees don't have, and that is to monitor and mentor ad hoc committees as if special issues come up of a strategic or policy nature, ad hoc committees need to be formed for that particular issue.
Yeah, clearly, because we only have three standing committees, so we're going to need ad hoc committees to take care of everything else.
Ad hoc committees take care of of the issues that they come up.
Right.
So that's their responsibility. On the other side of the picture is the assessment committee. And the assessment committee simply assesses how we have done, okay? And that includes the audit function. And the in states such as California, where you need a separate audit committee, a subcommittee of that assessment committee performs the audit function, meets with the auditors. This all feeds up to the executive committee, the third committee, which has the traditional executive committee duties of acting for the board in emergency situations, and taking a final review of the various reports that are coming through before they come to the board. So if you say have a board of 21 people with seven on each, you will find that by the time it gets to the board through the processes, a large part or nearly all of the board are familiar with the issues. They may disagree with some of the proposals and have other ideas at the board meeting, but everybody is pretty much everybody is fully informed.
Now, you say 21 board members as an example, so this is can this corporate model work for organizations that have just maybe half a dozen board members? You know, they're much smaller.
Yeah, we could divide that in four or however we want to arrange that, depending upon the needs of the corporation, of the nonprofit. This is a flexible model, okay, and people have used it in different ways. For example, I once met a person. An organization that didn't have any standing committees. All committees of the board were ad hoc committees, reporting to the entire board. They were happy with it. I wouldn't have been happy with it, but it evidently it worked. It worked for them.
All right. All right. So there is flexibility. Is this more what we see in corporations? I mean, you have to help me out because I'm not familiar with the corporate model. Is this more typical of the way corporate boards operate? Very few standing committees, maybe not exactly the same, but very few standing committees, lots of ad hoc committees?
Well, this is being proposed by the by some major consultants now, as you noted in the book. However, I hate to say, but I've been at this for more decades than I care to admit. And in turn, there are, as far as I know, based on the sales of the first two books, first two editions, sales of over 10,000 copies, I would estimate that thousands of boards have adopted it. However, it is still controversial among some boards. And it's best used with boards who have about $1 million budgets and roughly, let's say, about over 10 to 12, 14 full-time employees. When it comes to the nascent type of nonprofit board, I think the traditional model of board involvement in operations is necessary because there is simply not the manpower to get it done. The basic problem in the process, in the change, is that boards begin with board involvement in operations, and when they grow, they still stick with the old model, stunting the growth of the organization, frustrating the chief executive office, operations officer, and missing huge opportunities that they could have.
Right, in their growth. Gene, I'm not clear on something. Is your recommendation for smaller organizations to stick with a more traditional, smaller, younger organizations, I guess? I mean,
yes.
More traditional board model?
If you have an organization with a budget, for instance, I know one that I've been very close to, what has a budget and does great work, charitable work, for $250,000 a year. In that case, I would stick with a traditional or organization. However, in the book, you still need to have an audit committee of some sort, and the book describes what is necessary to have that, once or twice a year, as the accounting issues and financial issues come up.
And of course, the corporate model is important to have in mind as the organization grows.
Exactly.
That's the transition.
In other words, go ahead.
I was just saying that's the transition that you're encouraging.
That's the transition. Yeah. And it allows you to grow to a very large organization if you want to go in that direction. And it is sort of mandated once you get a larger number of employees and larger finances to handle. If you're in the area of over $1 million, if you're in the area of 1.5, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 million, and so forth. I had one client a couple of years ago that still had the old model, and they had a budget of $6 million. And the chief executive officer said to me, look, I could be running away with this board. They're just not supporting me in the way they should be supporting me. They're worrying about the details, the operational details that they hear about.
Now, that's the policy versus paperclips.
Yeah.
And,
they're worrying about, hypothetically, the paperclips.
Yeah. Just to remind listeners that Gene Fram is professor emeritus at Rochester Institute of Technology and the author of that book, Policy versus Paperclips.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Gene, what can we expect aside from maximizing our growth potential? Sounds like more efficient operations. What else can an organization expect if they adopt this corporate model of board governance?
All right. One is the board members feel that they are doing meaningful things.
Oh, yeah.
They see that they're proposing projects, they're monitoring their development, they're getting to know the staff, so if the succession issue comes up, they know who the prime candidates might be, and they become really more involved with the organization. As I indicate in Policy versus Paperclips, the ideal organization is a partnership between the board, the management group, and the staff. They are all working together. There's communications there, ideally, and they're all focusing on the objective of meeting the needs and the growing needs of the clients.
Okay, we just have about a minute and a half or so before a break. What about employees who are accustomed to going to board members with problems? That I assume that's got to stop.
Yes, that has to stop. That's what they refer to as the end run in the nonprofit organization. So the end runs have to stop, and everybody has to understand that it has to stop.
So that people are not reporting to board members; they're reporting to their supervisor, or maybe it's the CEO and president. But
yes,
but we can't be going to board members for everyday problems.
No, we can't. Pay salary levels, problems with promotions, and so forth and so on. That's particularly difficult in smaller communities, where many of the employees might know the board members personally.
Yeah.
So that becomes important. So there is a transition period, which can take anywhere from 2 to 3, maybe even 4 years, while this adjustment takes place.
Okay, Gene, we have to take a break. We'll have plenty of time more to talk after this. After we go away for a couple minutes, I'll come back. Tony's Take Two, and we'll keep talking to Gene Fram about the corporate model. Stay with me.
We got more with Gene Fram, of course, coming up. First, Pursuant. It's a simple problem solution statement. You need to raise more money. The Pursuant tool, Velocity, helps you. How can I make it simpler? It's one of the one of their tools that it's designed to keep fundraisers on track with goals, and that's whether you have devoted gift officers, or you're the sole fundraiser or director of development, or you're the executive director doing fundraising. Probably all the more reason you need technology. I mean, the smaller the shop, the more efficient you need to be. I'm going to be going to NTC, Nonprofit Technology Conference. I've got lots of technology interviews coming up. More about that shortly. But you need technology. Velocity is one of these tools that can help you. No more index cards. I hope that's an allegory by now. But or spreadsheets. Please check out these tools. Pursuant.com. Crowdster. They have a deal for Nonprofit Radio listeners. Either get 30 days free or 50% off. That means you can try a Crowdster peer-to-peer fundraising site completely free for a month, or you get the 50% off, which means pay for a month and get a month free, or pay for 2 months, get 2 months free. Add it on. Claim your Crowdster deal, whichever one works better for you, claim it at crowdster.com. And in the chat window, tell them you're from Nonprofit Radio and which deal you want. They're all prepared. Crowdster.com. Now time for Tony's Take Two. A dream realized. Since I was 5 years old, roughly, I have wanted a house by the beach. My grandmother and grandfather, Grandma and Grandpa Martinetti, used to take me to the beach in Belmar, New Jersey. And they had a home there. And my parents would just drop me and my brother off for weeks at a time during the summer. And even when school was, you know, even before I was school age, but then school time, you know, summer vacation, of course, weeks at a time, we'd be at Grandma and Grandpa's Belmar, New Jersey beach house. And I got sand in my blood. And I have realized the dream. I now own a home in Emerald Isle, North Carolina. And the beach is across the street. And along with the beach comes this ocean that is 24/7. It's remarkable. It never stops. And I hear the ocean. I see it. It's across the street. It's my across the street neighbor. So it's all pretty special. No longer in New York City full time now, just part time. More time down in Emerald Isle. And there's a video called My Dream Realized, and that's at TonyMartinetti.com. Want a little more detail about this, but very special. Realized dream. Nonprofit Technology Conference. It's coming up. It's later this month, March 23rd to 25th. I'll be in San Jose, California. I hope you're going to be there. I've been talking about it. It's an excellent conference. Lots of smart people helping you use technology, as I was saying earlier. You need it. You can't get away from it. And if you're not using it, not embracing it, not just like, you know, neutral on it, but if you're not embracing it, you're probably not as efficient as you could be in lots of different operations, fundraising, program, other administration, HR, time management, you know, whatever it is, you need to be embracing technology in 2016. Pursuant is going to be there. They're going to be right near me. I'll be getting interviews on the exhibit floor space. I'll have a booth. And then we got a green room right next to that for guests who come early. big establishment for nonprofit radio, big presence there. Pursuant will be right near. And I'm expecting to get around 30 interviews, maybe even a little more over the 3 days. This is my third NTC. The interview schedule, I'm going to put that up at TonyMartinetti.com. You can see who's coming up, which days. The conference info is at N10.org. And that is Tony's Take Two for the 280th show. 300th show is going to be coming up. The anniversary is always July. I don't know exactly which day. I didn't look to count it out. But the 300th show is going to be coming up in July. That'll be our sixth anniversary. Let's do, I feel like live listener love. So let's hit the live listeners. And there are many. I've got some of my new neighbors in North Carolina. New Bern is with us. And Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Thank you very much. Live listener love there. But also Cleveland, Ohio. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where I spent a very formative 4 years at Carnegie Mellon University. I was able to graduate in 4 years. That was remarkable. Class of 1980. No, wait. Class of 1984. No, 1984. That's right. 1980 was the Golden Knights at Northern Valley, Old Tappan. Learning, I'm opening up a lot today. It's unusual. Yes, class of 1984, Carnegie Mellon. Pittsburgh, PA, live listener love to you. Coming back to New Jersey, Florham Park. Cool. Brooklyn, New York, live listener love. Oh, there's another. Duncan, South Carolina, not too far from North Carolina. Los Angeles, California, Nyack, New York. Welcome. I don't think I've seen Nyack before. St. Louis, Missouri. I was stationed in Whiteman Air Force Base in Knob Noster, Missouri. But I did not live in Knob Noster. I lived in Warrensburg. Man, somebody puts all this info together. That's all on Facebook anyway, I think. So St. Louis. Yes, I used to spend time in St. Louis. We would take a train from St. Louis down to Mardi Gras. Did that for 2 years in a row from the beautiful St. Louis train station. St. Louis, live listener love to you. Atlanta, Georgia, and San Jose, California, where I will be in, 10 days or so, roughly. Let's go abroad. Mexico City, Mexico. Buenos tardes. Tehran, Iran. I don't know how to say it, but live listener love to you. I don't know the, Farsi? I don't know Farsi. I'm sorry. I hope you'll accept my live listener love in Tehran. Tokyo, multiple in Tokyo, Japan. Of course, konnichiwa. And Seoul, South Korea, always checking in. And multiple there, too. My always question, do you know each other? Annyeonghaseyo. Also, Bolivia is with us. Bolivia, welcome. Live listener love. Okay, let's get back to Eugene Fram and his book. His book, of course, Policy versus Paperclips. Gene, let's keep talking.
Okay.
What about... you mentioned just briefly. Let's talk a little about assessing the work of the CEO. Who does that fall under in this corporate model?
Well, that's the assessment committee.
Oh, makes sense.
And
yes.
Ideally, the assessment committee looks at two aspects of the CEO's work and the organization's outcomes. You don't look for processes; you look for outcomes. And these can be those data which are what we might call hard data, and that's the data that you have with accounting records, records of membership, number of clients, things of that nature that you can easily measure. And then there are their qualitative measures that you can measure, should measure, which many organizations don't measure. For instance, impact on the community, image in the community. Things of that nature are more qualitative. And in that area, I suggest that you do what we call use imperfect metrics. In fact, I have an article out on it, and I'm sure if any of if you take a look at my website, you will see it there. Or if you even put it in under my name, you will find it. It is available on on the web, and that is a process that I suggest. With a co-author, that if you use imperfect metrics over time, that you can drive progress and develop exchange, develop change. Excuse me.
Gene's blog. It's a little lengthy, so I'm going to suggest that the easiest way to find Gene is to do a Google search on Eugene Fram.
But yes, thank you very much. I have now have I have an anniversary right now. I've just put out my 150th blog, titled "What Nonprofits CEOs Think of Their Boards." Okay. Other recent ones are "Program Reductions Are Mandated. What Can a Nonprofit Do?"
Okay.
Another one, just for example, is "Management Knows All. What does what's a nonprofit director to do?"
Okay, and people will find you really, I think, easiest through a Google search. Now, this
just put my name into Google, right. And there's a lot of links there for you.
This use of imperfect data, Gene. Why don't you say a little more about that? Doesn't sound like something we'd want to rely on.
Well, if your process is good and you sample reasonably well, you can get data that is not exact, but you get a feel for it. For example, I once was on the board of a charitable nonprofit that was targeted to counsel various people in the community. It was heavily supported by the United Way. Mm-hmm. And we weren't getting many respondents from the inner city. So I suggested, as the board member, that I talk with some of the people in the community, what at that time known as the settlement houses, and see how in the inner city, which were community centers, which is a better word for them, and see what they perceived as the problem. Mm. So I went to them, and I found out what they thought were the problems. And now I'm only talking to three people, but they knew the communities there. And the first thing that happened was the EDs of the community centers called my president and CEO and says, "Guess what? One of your board members coming down to talk to me." So he said, "Yeah, I know." And we had agreed to this prior to that. And so I listened to these people. I came back. I gave him feedback. He made changes to try to garner a greater proportion of the clientele from the inner city. And then after a year, went back and talked to the people, and I said, "Is there many changes?" And they said, "Yes, there's been modest changes, but mm-hmm. there's still more that needs to be done." I fed this back to the president and CEO. He made changes. And then at the end of the second year, there were substantial changes, and the board got out of the business of evaluation at that point.
All right. So by some key interviews of the right people,
right?
Yeah, we don't have statistical significance and
exactly,
but everything that surrounds proper peer-reviewed research. But who can afford to do all that all the time?
Exactly, and the article contains practical examples where both myself and my co-author Jerry Talley, a sociologist, who both of us have been in the business a long time, have used the model and have found it very, very helpful. And over time, if you repeat this as I did in the example I gave you, it was only about a 2-year run until things started to turn around, and then the CEO was evaluated on going from there.
You mentioned earlier something I want to spend a little more time with, the proper title, your recommendation for title for the chief of the organization. You feel pretty strongly that executive director is not sufficient.
No, executive director can mean various things because it's used in a wide variety of ways. An executive director can be a volunteer who manages the budget of a small church with a, let's say, a $200,000 budget. An executive director can be, for instance, one I've encountered recently was the head of a $10 million charitable organization with over 100 employees. And I don't think the title executive director in the 21st century, even in the last part of the 20th century, gives the chief executive officer of a nonprofit the position and stature that he or she needs to work effectively.
So what do you prefer to see?
I prefer once you get into the make the transition, I prefer president and CEO because people understand there what that means. It's clear that that person has responsibility for operations except those decisions that have to be made by the board.
And that title may have significance for board members also, that they recognize the responsibilities of the president and CEO.
Exactly. And to add to that, in many cases, the nonprofit president and CEO has more management responsibility than a number of the members of the board. For instance, if you're a professor, you often don't have any management responsibilities, have never had it, okay? Mm-hmm. You've worked as an individual contributor. Same thing about a physician who has a single practice. Same thing with a lawyer who has a single practice, or even as a part of a major law firm. They just haven't had the responsibility of the chief executive has of the nonprofit organization.
Implementing this corporate model seems to me there's a lot of trust between board members, between the board and the president CEO, between the staff of the organization and the president CEO, between the staff and the board. It sounds like there's a lot of trust required.
Yes, you have to have trust. It's really and you picked it up exactly. It is a trust model. It's a model in which you have to trust the CEO, and you have to trust the staff that they are professionals. But on the other hand, it also calls for rigorous evaluation. It's not the traditional evaluation of the board or the staff where they send out a questionnaire at the end of the year and ask people to return it. You don't get full returns, and the questionnaire is poorly formatted. It takes investigation and robust evaluation.
And what are we going to do with trustees who are reluctant to give up the managing the paperclips responsibilities? How do we manage those people?
With difficulty.
Yeah, okay. Okay. I hope you got something better than that. Otherwise, I'm taking you off.
No.
I'm going to shut your mic down if that's the best you can do.
No.
No.
With some people, you have to give them what they might consider meaningful activities, such as chairing the annual dinner and things of that nature. Who are not working,
okay.
Who are not interested in the policy. For instance, if you have a major donor, who just is not interested in policy and strategy and wants to do that. Over time, what you hope will happen with the corporate with my model is that the board will turn over to people who have these dynamic interests and understand that they have to do a robust evaluation, not a cursory one, and that the majority of the board will be those types of people.
We got to take a break.
Mm-hmm.
Gene Fram stays with me, and I certainly hope that you do too.
Like what you're hearing on Nonprofit Radio? Tony's got more. On YouTube, you'll find clips from his stand-up comedy, TV spots, and exclusive interviews. Catch guests like Seth Godin, Craig Newmark, the founder of Craigslist, Mark Echo of Echo Enterprises, Charles Best from DonorsChoose.org, Aria Finger of DoSomething.org, and Naomi Levine from New York University's Hyman Center on Philanthropy. Tony tweets, too. He finds the best content from the most knowledgeable and interesting people in and around nonprofits to share on his stream. If you have valuable info, he wants to retweet you. During the show, you can join the conversation on Twitter using hashtag Nonprofit Radio. Twitter is an easy way to reach Tony. He's at Tony Martinetti, MARTIGNETTI. Remember, there's a G before the N. He hosts a podcast for the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Fundraising Fundamentals is a short, monthly show devoted to getting you over your fundraising hurdles. Just like Nonprofit Radio, Tony talks to leading thinkers, experts, and cool people with great ideas. As one fan said, Tony picks their brains and I don't have to leave my office. Fundraising Fundamentals was recently dubbed the most helpful nonprofit podcast you have ever heard. You can also join the conversation on Facebook, where you can ask questions before or after the show. The guests are there too. Get insider show alerts by email. Tony tells you who's on each week and always includes links so that you can contact guests directly. To sign up, visit the Facebook page or TonyMartinetti.com.
If you have big ideas but an average budget, tune into Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio for ideas you can use. I do. I'm Dr. Robert Penna, author of the Nonprofit Outcomes Toolbox.
Welcome back. We're wrapping up. We have about another 5 minutes or so, and want to continue with Gene for that time and talk about some of the advice that you have around weak board practices. There's something on your blog. There are a few posts on your blog about overcoming weak board practices. One of those is one of those bad practices is overlooking absences. What do you suggest there? What's the problem, and what do we do?
Well, you have board members who fill a board member's board position, and they're consistently absent. And this is a very touchy situation. They may be very fine people, have great skills, but they simply don't have the time to attend board meetings, which are obviously critical to the organization. I think the best thing you can do is to try to talk to these people, try to retain them on the board, or understand what they're missing by not attending the board meetings. In some instances, it can be a termination discussion. For instance, I just recently encountered one in which the board chair had this discussion with the person, and she said, "I'm just sorry. I like the organization, and I'm tied to the mission, vision, and values, but I'm doing international travel, and the best I can do is to open up the position and resign." In other cases, if you can find the root cause of it and do something about it for them, that can be another alternative. But it's very situational and very individual to see what you can do to handle the situation.
You had suggested earlier there may be a different role for the person. Maybe it's not on the board, but maybe there's something else they can do to support the organization.
Yeah. In this one instance that I just mentioned, I had talked to this individual, and I said to her, "Well, look, it's obvious that you can't do anything immediately, but your role may in your job may change again. Have you asked about taking a leave of absence from the board, and it's future time, a year and a half, 2 years, maybe things change around, and so she's still connected to the board in some way, may even get minutes of the board and so forth and so on, as a way of retaining that person's mm-hmm. interest in the organization, because she's a very fine person, thoughtful, analytical, does critical thinking, and had very broad experiences, kind of the dream board member.
Mm-hmm.
So you try to make these accommodations.
What about insufficient due diligence on the board? First, how are we going to recognize that?
Well, I think that's again the board chair's responsibility, along with the chief executive officer. When things are not discussed in adequate detail, that they bring the issues up, that they try to do some of the due diligence for the people. Because, again, the board members are not being compensated by large. They have other jobs that are their main concern. And so you may need to help them along on the due diligence side.
Gene has other identified board weaknesses and how to overcome them on his blog. Gene, what is it that you love about working on boards?
Well, I like the people, and I've served on a number of human services or charity type boards, as well as trade associations and so forth. But on the boards that especially those that are charitable in nature, you see in these organizations people who figuratively stand 10 feet tall. They do much more than they are compensated for. They do it willingly, and they really have the client's interest at mind, at heart, and in their mind. I've seen social workers in homes, in group homes, take some of their clients to their own homes on weekends, or even take them on vacations far beyond what is required of the people in order to help them overcome the handicaps that they have. Those are just examples. And when you see people like that really dedicated, and you can contribute in your way. I can't do those sort of things, but I can contribute to their doing it.
We have to leave it there. Eugene Fram, Professor Emeritus at Rochester Institute of Technology. Google him. Remember, it's like the Fram oil filters, FRAM. Google him to find his blog. His book is Policy versus Paperclips. It's on Amazon. Gene, thank you so much for being a guest.
Well, thank you for having me.
Been my pleasure. Next week, Professor Adrian Sargent on relationship fundraising. Did you think that I forgot the affiliate affections and podcast pleasantries? Perish the thought. Podcast pleasantries. To those listening on whatever device or whatever time, you're very welcome at Nonprofit Radio, and I'm very grateful for your support. Pleasantries to you. And affiliate affections, especially our newest affiliate, WLRI Lanchester. Affections out to all the AM and FM station listeners throughout the country. If you missed any part of today's show, I beseech you, find it on TonyMartinetti.com. Where in the world else would you go? And I just don't know about that. We're sponsored by Pursuant, online tools for small and mid-sized nonprofits, data-driven and technology-enabled, Pursuant.com. And by Crowdster, online and mobile fundraising software for nonprofits, now with Apple Pay, Crowdster.com. Today's show is dedicated to my Aunt Josie, who just died this past week. Not a blood aunt, but one of those aunts that just, she was an aunt even though she wasn't a blood aunt. Aunt Josie, love you. I miss you already. Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. Sam Leibowitz is the line producer. Gavin Dahl is our AM and FM outreach director. The show's social media is by Susan Chavez, and our music is by Scott Stein. Be with me next week for Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Go out and be great.
What's not to love about Nonprofit Radio? Tony gets the best guests. Check this out from Seth Godin.
This is the first revolution since TV 1950 and Henry Ford 1920. It's the revolution of our lifetime.
Here's a smart, simple idea from Craigslist founder Craig Newmark.
Yeah, in sites or in presentation or anything, people don't really need the fancy stuff. They need something which is simple and fast.
When's the best time to post on Facebook? Facebook's Andrew Noyes knows.
At traffic is at an all-time high around 9 a.m. or 8 p.m. So that's when you should be posting your most meaningful posts.
Here's Aria Finger, COO of DoSomething.org.
Young people are not going to be involved in social change if it's boring and they don't see the impact of what they're doing. So you got to make it fun and applicable to these young people, because otherwise a 15 and 16-year-old, they have better things to do. They have Xbox, they have TV, they have their cell phones.
Ami Dar is the founder of Idealist.
It took 2 or 3 years for foundation staff to sort of deign to add an email address to their card. Yeah, it was like, yes. It was phone. This email thing is right. Weird. And plus, why should I give it away?
Charles Best founded DonorsChoose.org.
Somehow they've gotten in touch, kind of offline, as it were.
Yeah.
And they'll do exchanges of brownies and visits and physical gift.
Mark Echo is the founder and CEO of Echo Enterprises. You may be wearing his hoodies and shirts. Tony talked to him.
Yeah, you know, I'm a big believer that it's not what you make in life. It's you know, it's how you make people feel.
This is public radio host Majora Carter.
Innovation is in the power of understanding that you don't just, you know, you just put money on a situation and expect it to heal. You put money on a situation and invest it and expect it to grow.
And savvy advice for success from Eric Saperston.
What separates those who achieve from those who do not is in direct proportion to one's ability to ask others for help.
The smartest experts and leading thinkers are on Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%.